thick of it, a profit and loss podcast with Colin Lambert and Galen Stobbs.
Welcome to In the Thick of It. The road trip continues. With me, as always, is Galen Stobbs, editor of P&L. I'm Colin Lambert, managing editor of P&L, and we're joined by our guest this week, John Ashworth, CEO of Caplin, and we're going to run through a range of things that we want to discuss. Before we do that, Galen, I do need to point out that a friend of mine got in contact, and I'm very grateful to him because I'd forgotten it myself, the developing scandal of the trend-following debate in the latest issue of P&L, where you've admitted to cheating and I've admitted to naivety.
I would add that unapologetically admitted, yes, to cheating.
That's good, yeah. I do need to point listeners in the direction of a most fantastic video. I've mentioned it in my column before on YouTube. And just type in the words Naim, N-A-I-M, and EFX. It is easily the funniest thing involving foreign exchange anywhere in the world. It's taken from an old Real Madrid thing. But he's talking about the trend-following algo. It's brilliant. So anyway,
did the trend-following algo just kill it out there?
No,
as per my debate argument?
No, it didn't.
It didn't?
It got two of the 50 in at a one-point profit. Unfortunately, the other 48 cost it nine big figures.
You know what? Look, just because it didn't work doesn't mean it can't work, Colin, all right? Maybe he was just doing it wrong. My argument still stands.
Could I say, Naim is never wrong, as you'll find out when you watch the YouTube video. Anyway, moving on to more mundane or more serious subjects. It's been quite an interesting week around the crypto space. John, you sat in on the crypto sessions there. What's your observations around crypto?
Well, the two things that struck me very much from this week, and by the way, it was a great conference, and I think the listeners should know before anything else that we're sitting in the very place where the conference took place yesterday and the day before, but today is the opening of the American Plastic Surgeons Conference. So we're sitting here slightly nervously, worried that somebody's going to burst in and offer us a nip or a tuck or an enlargement or a reduction or something. So
all we're saying is you won't recognise Colin the next time you see him.
Exactly. Anyway, back at the topic of crypto, I think two observations I took. Firstly, just to step sideways to make a point, I reckon that Obama's second term, which coincided with general availability of high-quality cameras on mobile phones, was probably the first presidency that was entirely captured. Every single second of his living life was captured digitally in photographic images, which is sort of something of a turning point. Bearing in mind that when Abraham Lincoln won his presidency, it took 8 days for the news to reach the west coast of America. So that was definitely a point of inflection. And I think it struck me that crypto currency is the first market in the history of mankind where every single transaction, by definition, has been captured digitally. So everything there is to know about the market historically is retained somewhere digitally, and that's a notable thing. The second thing I would observe from the week's discussions is that this is now clearly a mainstream market. 2 years ago at this conference, people were wondering even about the ability to separate blockchain and distributed ledger technology from cryptocurrencies themselves. I think last year that separation was well and truly made, but the relevance of distributed ledger technology was to be determined, and the relevance of the currencies themselves was to be determined. And I think, paradoxically, the relatively poor attendance for some of the crypto sessions was testimony to the fact that lots of people know about it already and are assuming it's part of the mainstream market and sort of didn't really feel the need to attend. And the other point is that many of the panelists on whatever topic, whether it was liquidity or it was data or it was market practices or it was global code, all had something credible to say about it. So, you know, definitely here to stay.
Mm. So I think on the point about everything, all the data being recorded electronically in the crypto space, to my mind, that's part of the reason why we've seen, in terms of the segments that are trading this asset, it's almost been the reverse of general segments. And what I mean is, typically you see kind of an institutional market, then you kind of see, you know, a retail, and then the prop shops, HFTs, are kind of the last ones in because they need that data. They need to have everything electronics for their systems, their models, etc. Whereas in crypto, we've seen the reverse, where it was this huge retail bend, and then the first ones we've seen get into the space have been the prop shops, HFTs. Yep. We're beginning to see hedge funds. There's, you know, talk of banks, asset managers getting in. pension funds, endowment funds, etc., are kind of going to be the last ones. But part of the reason why the prop shops have got into it, even though a lot of the trading happens on bloody Skype group chats, which still blows my mind sometimes, the fact that they have all the data there from day one of the trading when it began, and they've been able to monitor it, is part of the reason why they're comfortable trading this asset class, because that's what they know. They need the data. They need to go through it. We've talked before about CTAs who are beginning to get into the space with kind of trend following models or mean reversion models, because they have that data all there ready to go.
Once again, I have to be the voice of reason, I think. Thank you for not laughing. I think, to me, the fact that everything is digitally recorded, I think the reason, you're 100% right on the prop shops. The CTAs, I think, is a developing story, but the prop shops is definitely there. But I think the prop shops are there because they see the opportunity to exploit an opportunity, and I legally exploit an opportunity, and that is you're dealing with relatively uninformed traders, which is the retail segment. That's 101 in terms, as a market maker, that's 101 in terms of where it's a lot easier to make
and
market.
And whopping great spreads.
Yeah, well, that's exactly. I just point out that Colin just talked about an opportunity for an opportunity.
Yes.
Like, I'm not going to let that go without comment. But secondly, like John's point, yeah, that they're there because there's spreads big enough to bloody drive your car through.
But, right? but also because, even with the bigger spreads, most of the people they're dealing with less informed than they are, because they don't have access to high-speed data. They have access to the latest trading data. Even though it's all available and everything is digitally recorded, they don't have access to that. My second point, I guess, would be that could be a potential ceiling on institutionalisation, which was spoken about quite a lot at the On The Block conference on Monday, which I think also maybe is why we were slightly less attended yesterday morning.
Exactly.
Because a lot of them were on the block. But I think that could be a natural ceiling, because if I'm a big player in a relatively small space, I need to make sure that information is not getting out. Because if I'm sitting there holding a good position and everyone knows it, a large position and everyone knows it, I'm vulnerable.
Well, firstly, I'd say On The Block might have had something to do with it. I think you're both being very polite. I think the night before might have had even more to do with the first panel of the day.
Yeah, the audience did grow through the morning, I have to say.
Yeah, I do.
The mining took place in Kingston.
Yes.
But I think exactly that's a good point, which is like, again, for example, the CTAs that I spoke to, I was saying to them, like, okay, so your trend following strategies are working really well right now because it's retail focus, herd mentality, everyone piles in one direction, piles in the other. We're talking about the institution, quote unquote, institutionalization of crypto.
We'll be analyzing the data.
Right, and that's going to reduce that factor.
Yeah.
And they're like, we're going to have to, adjust our models, change our strategies, because eventually that opportunity will disappear, and then we're going to have to do something else. So it'll be interesting to see to what extent, as it institutionalizes, it's still exciting, because we talked about spreads are huge at the moment, but those are going to keep compressing.
Naturally.
And it'll be interesting, because I spoke to the exchanges when they launched their futures products last year, right? I was saying to them, okay, so why are you launching this now? And the general response was, oh, because, all our clients were asking for it, there's so much excitement around it, that's why we wanted to launch it. I was like, okay, people are asking for it and there's excitement because the price keeps going up, because the price keeps going up, they keep reading stories about it, so then they get more excited and then they want it, and it becomes this circle, this bubble, right? But what happens when that pops? And I never got a really good answer about why people fundamentally would want to trade this product when it wasn't just going up, 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 up.
And to my point in the midweek podcast special, the last month has seen Bitcoin in less than $1,000 range. Inevitably, if the opportunities diminish and the spreads do not diminish at the same pace, then traders are going to suddenly work out that, guess what, I'm not actually making the money. The opportunities only exist for me that did. Yeah.
I think the other interesting thing is the what will be the random seemingly random emergence and seemingly random departure and disappearance of certain coins. So the liquidity will cluster around, I think, more than one, but certainly not more than 10. And there will be shocks and surprises for people who, as we said earlier, on the basis of fear of missing out, piling into the Wild West, and we'll just get caught with their trousers down.
FOMO is the ultimate trend following strategy.
Yeah. But you're talking about like, oh, it's within 1,000, right? Mm. Like, that just shows how much we've adjusted the crypto market.
Absolutely.
Within 1,000? Like,
yeah.
That's huge.
It's huge.
Like, imagine if anything else you were like, oh, yeah. It was just within 1,000 range either side now.
Hang on, Galen. I'm an old cable driver from the 80s. We did 7 big figures a day and went to lunch.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Oh, the good old days stories.
Exactly,
The good old bad days.
Let's get into those ones, yeah. I guess to my point, though, about the ceiling, is that the institutions, and a lot of big institutions and banks have looked at crypto and decided to put it on hold. And I think the reason they're doing that is because they're worried about building up too much inventory, which will be available to people of the same quality in terms of their ability to analyse the market. At the moment, when it's retail dominated, that's great, because most retail punters are in there just trying to make a buck. They're not worrying about, what's the positions out there, what's the relative positions, that was the last trade went through, I don't care about that. There'll be guys out there mining that information. We're mining for Bitcoin, but they'll be mining the data on the blockchain, and that then makes it vulnerable to a trader holding large inventory.
By the way, if you hear a crackling noise, that's Colin fidgeting with his bottle of water. I think he might be hungover today.
Yeah, that's why Galen sounds like Barry White from 1974. I guess one other point on the crypto thing as well. We published earlier this week a story by Justin Stalter of Mercury Strategies. And the headline is the golden age of crypto over? And I guess there's two related points to it. I mean, Justin's point was with the fantastic New York Attorney General's spat with Kraken that we discussed on this podcast last week, still one of my more enjoyable things of the year. An early contender for an irrational in my end of year awards. But Justin's point was that the regulators are now taking a severe interest in this, and that could mean that the golden age, the freedom that the crypto markets had to develop, will be over. And actually, this morning there was news that a US federal judge had given CFTC effectively jurisdiction over crypto in a judgment. So, is regulation going to? I mean, is this world ready for regulation? Do you think?
So it's interesting. We had a debate yesterday morning on whether we need a global code for crypto, and it was difficult. So my takeaway from that was, and I wish I'd. We only had half an hour for it. I could have gone for a lot longer on that. Because my takeaway was that the two people I was kind of grilling on this very much seemed to suggest that, yes, the simple answer is yes, we absolutely do. But the challenges in implementing something like that are astronomical. Because unlike FX, FX is a global market with no one central hub, but at least you have kind of global FX committees at every central bank who can kind of cajole, prod, encourage people to adhere to this thing. Crypto, there's nothing like that. It's not a global market. It's regional. You have like a US market, you have an APAC market, you have all of these different markets. And so just doing that, trying to actually implement standards for something, the infrastructure isn't built out yet. So what's it going to look like? So how do we have rules around what needs to be done when we don't know what it's going to look like? Very, very hard. And do we ultimately need regulation? So the thing I hear from crypto people all the time, right, is they want they don't want regulation, but they want regulatory clarity. I'm like, what does that mean, right?
Yeah.
they don't want more regulation, but they want to have someone lay out the rules of the road for them.
Yeah.
There's an implicit in that is the assumption that somebody's written down the rules and they're tucked away in the back of a textbook to which we haven't quite found the key to the locker yet.
The dog ate my homework.
Exactly. So it's a bizarre question to demand regulation for a market, as Gaydon says, and we don't know quite how it's going to be traded and how it's going to transact. On the other hand, I think there was a mood in the room that around the global code conversations that much of it was like the driving test, to do with achieving a certain standard of competence, but doesn't necessarily make you a better driver. And actually, what's needed is people to go out, they know what's right, they know what's wrong. There's a moral code, there's a code of sensibility. Data transparency, I suppose, throws more light on the way people actually behave. A sensible practice will emerge from that without having to have a 245 clause thing written down saying how it should work. Regarding Colin's observation that regulatory control or oversight has gone to the CFTC, I'm sure many people would welcome. I'm not sure how much longer he's in the job, but Chairman Giancarlo, I will name drop and say my old colleague back at the days of Fenix.
I forgot we had a connected person.
Yes, we had a connected, exactly.
We're not used to this level of insight.
Hang on. That's me just lifting the name up off the floor that I dropped.
And we should get autographs after this.
Definitely get autographs after this. You know, he's got this great fintech initiative going on. I think there's a massively oversubscribed conference. So he's on it like a bonnet in terms of what new technology ought to be able to do and about putting, if not complete regulatory framework, at least some sensible thinking around effectively taking a new digital approach to analog behaviour. As we said at the top of this podcast, it's an asset class. It's a market that's entirely captured digitally, but the behaviours of the new entrants, the retail entrants, motivated by fear of missing out, although they've got lots of spare cash.
We just have a couple of minutes.
We just had an interruption into our room. Is motivated by analog considerations.
So, do you want to pause? Good interruption from someone trying to load up some of the aforementioned medical equipment, no doubt. It's interesting that, John, you're talking about the code, and we did have a discussion on the global code. I just wanted to sort of maybe give a shout out, I guess, to NEX, because they announced yesterday that they've... It's only a small step, don't get me wrong, but they announced yesterday that they are identifying on their monthly reports on EBS Direct and EBS Select those firms that have adhered to the global code. So any participant on the market can actually easily see the behaviours of those firms that have attested to the code and those that haven't. To me, this is a real life case, of someone actually putting the code to use, which I think is a positive. I guess my question is, what other real life cases can we put the code to work on? Difficult one, isn't it? I mean, then that's the thing. I think that's our challenge, is what we've got to look at there. So,
Just to jump in there, I'm a fan of anything that names and shames.
Yeah.
That's why I love the AG report on crypto. Name and shame them, that's what I say.
Yeah, and actually, maybe fiat can actually learn something from the crypto world there, in terms of, actually, guess what, you know, I was quite pleased with Adrian Boland's comments on the Global Code panel on the first day of the conference, when he turned around and said, explicitly said, the Global FXC is going to engage with those that haven't signed a statement of commitment. Because to me, and I've been arguing this, and Gail and I have been discussing this for months now, the GFXC needs to get away from, look how successful we've been in getting these 450, 500 names, the majority of which are sell side, and let's actually look at what we need to do to engage the others. Why are these reputable firms not signing the statement of commitment? We need to understand that a bit better. So, yeah, it's a good development.
It is a good development, and it's also a way of saying thank you to the considerable number of people who spent considerable number of hours putting the code together in the first place. So there's some endorsement, some ratification, some relevance of it, and I'm sure other platforms and institutions and indeed vendors may follow suit in finding ways to accredit it. With that said, I think it's also worth noting that the people who put all that hard work in, generally speaking, will be the people who were going to behave properly anyway. So
that is so true. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not as if the crooks are going to come out of the woodwork and say, "Ta-da! This is what we should be doing." Sorry, it's a fair cop, mate. Yes,
and that's to Galen's point: name and shame. I honestly think we should be naming and shaming everybody here, because I think it just makes life so much better. But so we'll have a we've had a shout out there to the next analytics guys.
One thing I want to talk about. So yeah. I sadly missed the Global Code panel because I was in an interview, but I had so many people come up to me and say, "Oh yeah, I went to the Global Code panel because I felt like I had to, do it." And then they said it was really, really good. And part of the reason they said it was really good because they said it was really honest panel, whereby, and they said part of the reason it was honest, you had people up there who were saying, in front of a, you know, a big audience, saying, yeah, no, I didn't read the thing, it was like really long, and yeah, I get a lot of these things, so I just take the box, sign the thing, and we move on, kind of thing.
And the fact is, actually, it's not long. That's the thing about it. The Global Code is not a long document in terms of guidelines. If you look at ACI's model code, I mean, it goes to hundreds and hundreds of pages. The FX Global Code is 55 principles over, I think, 75 pages, including all the examples. I mean, it's I mean,
but the point was, they get that, they get MiFID II, they get everything landing on the desk, they get hundreds of pages. It's like, all right, is like, just like, give me the cliff notes. Is this a good thing? Okay, great, sign it. Sign it, let's move on, let's go.
3 years ago, when the Global Code was 1 year that they launched the first Asia Global Code, we did a panel with in New York with David Puth and Guy DeBell, who literally had come from the press conference at the New York Federal Reserve to turn around and you know, to launch the code. And as we got up on stage, half the audience got up and left. And I turned around to Guy then and said, like, there's your problem right there walking out the door. So the fact that, yes, people felt they obliged to go there because they want to understand it, but also... you know, they got an honest panel. It's good that we're being honest about the code. It's not a perfect scenario, but it's the best we got. So I think, yeah, hopefully that's positive. Moving on, we spoke in the midweek podcast about data, and John, you actually appeared on the data panel.
I did.
The second day, which was recorded after our podcast. So any ignorant comments, we'll just blame on our three guests, because Gail and I were obviously perfect. What were your observations from that panel? Because I mean, it was a really good session, totally engaging. I think I think I asked three questions. It's a perfect session when I'm involved to that degree.
Where to start? The first thing to say is that, despite any appearance to the contrary, there is no question that data storage and data processing costs are just collapsing year after year in whatever derivative of Moore's law applies. So there's no reason for not being able to store and process huge amounts of data. There are incredibly exciting new technologies emerging in the market, not just in new programming languages, but obviously new techniques around machine learning and artificial intelligence. On the panel, however, we provided some sort of reality check around all the froth and excitement associated with this new data science. And the reality checks come in all sorts of forms. Firstly, I'm pretty certain that the rate of development of new technology exceeds the ability of the universities and colleges to produce graduates who are skilled in these areas. So you're having to rely, to get skilled up and kitted out in this area, you're having to rely on very smart, curious, self-driven, self-determined people.
So does that mean in 3 years' time there's going to be an influx?
I don't think there'll be a sudden influx. I think gradually people will get more with it. Yeah. And of course, having people who only know about data is pretty irrelevant if you're bringing them into a trading environment where they need to know about trading workflows as well. Mm. So actually, I think it's the kids currently employed by banks or non-bank financials or hedge funds or prop firms who are, you know, 5 years in, but are just innately curious. And that's where the real skills and labour force will come from. The second thing is, I'm highly sceptical, even in this day and age, about the relevance of the adjective artificial in AI, on the basis that the notion that you can put all this data and you can put all these techniques into a food processor, press start, and then pop out with all sorts of weird and wonderful correlations and trading suggestions and interesting hypotheses, I think is as yet untested. And actually, you still need human beings who understand the workflow, who understand if there's a discontinuity in the data, you know, is that a maximum or a minimum or a point of inflection? What is the meaning of that? How is that relevant to our business? What are we going to do with that? So there's lots to think about there in the human domain expert rules quit person bringing life to all of this. And the other thing, and listeners maybe find it rather odd that we gave a bit of a shout out to the Global Code 10 minutes ago in this podcast, but an interesting consequence of MiFID, which on the one hand has represented a sort of lost generation of innovation in banks because they've all had to stop doing interesting things like competing with each other and developing new systems whilst they've gone into converted canteens that have become action rooms for MiFID. A consequence of that is that it has forced a microscopic view on metadata and data sources within the bank. So banks, generally speaking, as a consequence of doing all the things they've had to do for their MiFID homework, have got a better idea where this data set is, that data set is, across asset classes, by customer segment, and so on and so forth. And that in itself is useful homework as preparation for more advanced data analytics work, because whether it was Fortran programs in the early 70s or it's machine learning in, you know, the 2020s, the same processes apply, which is, what's the business problem? Where's my data? How do I clean my data? And then and only then can you do the processing on it. And then and only then can you draw the conclusions and feedback, not in a linear way, but in a circular way, and make the process go round and round again. So the boring bits in, the exciting bits in that are the processing. That's where the AI and the machine learning promises. But the boring bits, which is where is the data in the first place, I think MiFID and the process of MiFID has actually helped in that. So in a bizarre kind of way, I'm sort of slightly optimistic that some good has come of that.
So you're talking about kind of getting the data and the human element. This ties into what we actually talked about, I think it was last week or the week before, about the article we did recently on kind of hedge funds and FX using AI, and how they were saying that for all the people getting excited about AI, it's still a massively labor-intensive process in terms of the people who are getting this data, the people who are tagging it, the people who are moving it. Then you've got to backtest it, then you do this, then you do that. Like, there's a lot of human labor involved in this quote-unquote AI-driven market right now.
Go back to 2001. Everyone's saying, oh, there'll be nobody left in foreign exchange, it'll all be done by machines. More people are employed in foreign exchange now than were employed in foreign exchange in, like, 1995.
Yeah, because the market's more diverse, there are more markets, there are more participants of different shapes and sizes.
It's just different skill sets. Yeah.
So one question that I jumped in and raised on your panel, which was, I mean, you're talking about costs collapsing, right? And yes, the cost in many cases of accessing, storing, analyzing, disseminating data has reduced massively. But is it a problem, to the point we talked about before with the haves and have-nots, right? That now there is so much data and so many data sources that actually the costs keep going down for individual use cases of the data, while my overall data costs keep going up?
Yeah, because people basically are saying, okay, well, I need it. I need data from, you know, the data from one source is 50% cheaper.
Yeah.
But I'm now taking it from five times the number of sources.
Yeah. Yes. That's empirically true. All the examples of the promise of artificial intelligence. I'll give you one. There's a fantastic example of predicting the price of wine. You know, artificial intelligence has within a tenth of a standard deviation predicted the future market price of certain vintages and this, that, and the other.
Shouldn't be mentioning the alcohol in front of Galen.
No, certainly not this morning. Hang on, what goes on the road stays on the road, Jackie, please.
Yeah. It's a tour issue.
But that particular example is slightly misleading. It's very illustrative, but it's slightly misleading because, of course, the data is freely available. You can go to all over the internet and find wine databases. Secondly, the field names of the databases are very intuitive. You don't really have to be an expert to know what vintages are and what bottle shapes are and what colours are and what years are and all the rest of it. When it comes to a fixed income database or a foreign exchange database, the field things are all different, probably within a bank. Banks have lots of static data about, you know, customers, but they probably have different names for the treasury relationship with that customer, the retail relationship with that customer, or the insurance relationship with that customer. So there's a huge amount of really dull preparatory work that has to be done. I think this is what Galen was talking about earlier, to get all this stuff together. So there's a huge amount to be done before you get to the start line. And it's not just the human cost, it's also the inertia, the political barriers about how banks are structured, and the bits you need actually don't belong to the person who is your boss. So there's all sorts of other obstacles to getting to the starting line before the race can kick off.
Yeah, I guess my observation to close that out would be that as I actually closed my panel yesterday, I just mentioned when I use the words artificial intelligence, I think of me, because artificial can also mean fake. we'll move on. We're gonna close out in just a second, but before we do, we thought we are on. This is a tour, the autumn tour special of In the Thick of It. We're going to quickly run around the three of us. Best swag from Forex Network Chicago.
Ooh, dear.
I'll go first because I'm really sad. The only thing I picked up from anyone was when I was getting a demo from someone and I picked up a pen.
Well, I got a mini speaker thing from Next. I haven't tried it out yet, but if that works, that will be awesome.
Excellent.
Also, I ate a whole pack of mints from Elysium yesterday because I think I could have killed a human with my breath.
I got some golf balls from Lucira, which are going to be in a lake or a forest. No time at all. But whilst we're talking about swag, can I also give a shout down for whoever it was, and I won't name them, who was giving out finger spinners, because I think that's so 2017. Yes, it really doesn't deserve at a conference like this.
I think the thing is, like, they weren't. I think what we're finding out, they weren't that popular in 2017 when they were hot, yes. And they're trying to get rid of them this year.
That would explain why the 7 was scratched out, and they threatened it with an 8.
Exactly.
Left over.
Yes, exactly. I think it's like, yeah, there's definite leftovers there. Okay, well, that's going to close us out. Our thanks to John for joining us on this session. Our thanks to our unwelcome interruption from the hotel staff wandering into the room with a case.
We'll be back next week talking about plastic surgery tips.
Yes, exactly. Have a good week,
happy
everyone.
Happy Tux.